Thanks for joining us again. I'm Gene Wilson, your host for this series on homosexuality, A Christian Response. You've selected the second tape in this series, titled When Homosexuality Hits Home. And our teacher for this series is Joe Dallas. Joe, in tape number one, you spoke on the need for the church to respond with a balance of grace and truth when it addresses homosexuality. Now, that's quite a challenge, isn't it?
Well, Gene, it's a huge challenge, but it's one that we're going to have to rise to. Well, let me tell you about an even greater challenge that we're going to look at in this tape. And that's the challenge of dealing with a homosexual loved one or friend when you yourself can't agree that homosexuality is normal or moral.
Now, there's a challenge, because we all want to be loving and accepting. But how can we show love and acceptance without compromising our values?
Well, that's the general question we're going to try to answer in this tape, along with some more specific practical questions about what to say, what not to say, and how to handle the different tough situations you might face when someone you love says, "You may not want to hear this, but I'm gay."
Then let's see now how we can respond to a gay friend or loved one, and what emotions we ourselves can expect to go through when homosexuality hits home.
I'm always so grateful when someone will come forward and put a face to what we're discussing. This really is not worth much if it's strictly academic when we can see flesh and blood examples of the grace of God manifest in someone's life. I think it gives us great hope, so I appreciate his willingness to offer himself in that way, and as well as leading in worship. One of my favorite movies of all time is a quiet little film by Robert Redford called A River Runs Through It. I don't know if any of you have seen that. It's a story of a Presbyterian minister who has two sons. You could draw the Cain and Abel parallels there. One stays rather conservative and the other is a chronic renegade, and both wonderful boys and young men who the father loves deeply. But as the narrator at the end of the film says, and of course he's speaking from the perspective of the surviving brother, it was a surprise to no one when the renegade son was tragically cut off early in life as a result of his violent and somewhat wanton lifestyle. And towards the end of the father's career, we see him speaking to a church out of not only doctrinal understanding, but certainly out of personal experience. And he's saying to the congregation, you know, sometimes those we love the most are the most unwilling or the most unable to accept our love and all that comes with it. And so we find ourselves in the painful position of wanting to offer something that cannot be received, but we can still love them in our own faltering, imperfect way. We can love when we do not understand. This is true in general of loving anyone. It is particularly true of loving someone who is homosexual. When homosexuality hits home, we are faced with something none of us wants to face, but all of us have to, and that is that love is not enough to accomplish all we want to accomplish. I think we grow up with mythical expectations of love. Not surprising, love is so powerful, so potent. Love of all sorts, certainly romantic love, parental love, brotherly love, the love of friendship. It is a force that makes us feel virtually invincible. We hear in fairy tales as we grow up that love is basically the summation of everything. They lived happily ever after. And, of course, the fact that they fell in love precipitated that happy ever after story. And the notion that is adopted is that love will solve all problems. If we just love somebody enough, that will make everything all right. And life, in its cruelty and its indifference to our expectations, teaches us that no, indeed, our love is not enough to force people to do what is right. And that is a God-ordained principle. For as soon as humanity was created, God endowed humanity with choice, that great liberty and that terrible snare. And without changing a fraction of his love, he endowed his creation with the capacity to make decisions on its own, even if they are the wrong decisions. And God never said, I will stop loving you if you make the wrong decisions, but nor did he say, my love for you will force you to make the right decisions. And so as we try to be more God-like, we're forced with this dilemma. Someone we love is engaged in something we know to be wrong. And we have the option of trying to kill our love then to make it stop hurting. Because what is more hurtful than loving someone who won't hear our plea to do what is right and having to watch them endure the consequences of their behavior? It would be more convenient if we could just switch it off, stop caring. Or we can use love as an excuse to overpower the individual, preach to them, intimidate them, harangue them, nag them, send them a book, drag them to a conference, anything but make them do what's right, all in the name of love. Which is a bit like Constantine marching his troops through the river and saying, okay, you're all baptized and saved. Good, now let's go fight. Nice try. But love, in all its splendor, does not force change. And that is, to me, one of the most difficult things about loving. I have both a 16-year-old stepson who I've spent most of the last 13 years raising. I have a beautiful baby, 17 months old, who I love more than I thought it was possible to love a human being. And already I'm getting the daddy terrors, and you know what I mean. All of the encyclopedia of things that you think of that could happen, and the wariness and the watchfulness and the fear and the laying awake and the realization that, oh my God, I'm not guaranteed of this kid's safety. I'm not guaranteed of his rightness in making decisions in the future. I don't know who's going to break his heart. I don't know what disease he's going to get. I don't know where he's going to end up. No guarantees, and yet I've got this ocean of love. It is wonderful, and it is terrifying. And it is, I believe, a part of experiencing intimacy with God, is feeling what God surely feels about his creation. That gift of free will that he will not rescind, where he basically says, you have choices. I'm here. I'll never leave you or forsake you, and nothing, nothing will separate you from my love. However, I will have to sit here and ache should you choose to make the wrong decisions. I won't force you. I'll woo you. I'll try to reach you. But you ultimately will make your own decisions. And so the test of our Christ-likeness is that test of being willing to love without forcing our loved one to do what is right, but at the same time not compromising our own position. And this is especially true when homosexuality hits home. Those of us who have a homosexual loved one have been told from many quarters many stupid things. I am amazed at the advice people give poor parents, wives, sisters, brothers, family members, ranging from accusations as in, what did you do to make that person homosexual, to things as ludicrous as one friend of mine got some advice from a traveling evangelist. I hope he has stopped traveling and found a place to park it. told her all she really needed was a little of his underwear that he could pray over and put oil on, and that would deliver the kid. It's all out there. It's all out there. From other quarters, we are told to simply accept our loved one's homosexuality. The problem is us. We're homophobic. We're ignorant. We're fundamentalists. We're unlearned. And interestingly enough, we feel very alone and very much a part of our loved one's process. My wife, who is going to begin a group again for wives of men who are involved in homosexuality, a little bit of a plug, you can sign up in the back there, but one of her clients some time ago put it very well when she said, you know, when my husband came out of the closet, he brought me with him. People don't come out alone. They all have families. They all have somebody who loves them and somebody who cares. And the dilemma is to maintain a Christ-like attitude and position. But before we look at what to do when homosexuality hits home, let's look a little bit at what happens when homosexuality hits the individual, because our loved one has already gone through quite a process before we ever found out about our loved one's homosexuality. There are very few things the gay activists say that I agree with, but one of those very few is this. No one chooses to be homosexual. That is, no one chooses to have sexual desires that are directed towards the same sex. No one makes that conscious choice. People absolutely make a conscious choice as to what they'll do with it. We choose our behavior. We choose whether or not we will engage in certain fantasies. We choose how we will reinforce that condition. But it is quite true that the homosexual condition, whether you call it the orientation, whether you call it the preference, whether you call it the condition, that internal condition is not chosen. It is discovered. And it is normally discovered with a great deal of fear. It is normally not celebrated when it is discovered. There is turmoil. And you can be sure that by the time your son, your daughter, your spouse, your sibling, your close friend, your parent has come to you and said, I am homosexual, you can be sure that that person has already been through a good deal of soul searching and questioning and probably a tremendous amount of pain. Because normally after it's discovered, it's immediately covered up again. As Ken was saying, and I think he took the route most of us took when we first realized those feelings were there. It ain't there. The good old Christian Science approach. I'm not, it's not, that's it. Not only because there is a fear of accepting something like that within ourselves, but also because of the feeling the family members may have about it. And so there's generally a time of real dread and fear. And the panic, so often, of a young person, an adolescent, usually discovering those feelings. The panic is the panic of someone having a condition that they don't know how to deal with and that they are afraid to name for fear of ostracization, misunderstanding, name-calling. Because children learn very early that one of the worst things they can be is different. And one of the worst ways to be different is to be queer, as they put it, or fag, or whatever. And so often those words are used as epithets with the children not even knowing what they mean, but they're still used. And suddenly the young girl, the young boy becomes aware of erotic feelings and thinks, wow, 2 and 2 is 4. The things they are saying to each other, those things apply to me. I'm one of those. And there is a time of tremendous uncertainty, of intimidation, and of isolation. I've worked with men and women who were in every way perfectly acceptable socially in their appearance, their demeanor, their actions, the way they presented themselves, but they grew up feeling different, feeling cut off. And that is an unforgivable crime in the schoolyard. to be different or afraid. So what do kids do when a little boy or girl or a young adolescent is hesitant and awkward and self-conscious? Do they all gather around and say, "Oh my goodness, you seem to be suffering from gender identity deficits. Can we affirm you?" No, the little darling's pecking to death. The name calling, the rejection, the position of the outcast, and the sense of hopelessness. Not only do I have a condition I didn't ask for, there must be something wrong with me to have attained it in the first place. I must have sinned, I must have screwed up, I must be a freak, I must be whatever. I can't talk about it, I don't know where to get any help, and so the isolation continues, the masquerading oftentimes continues as they try to date, they try to be something they're not, and they find that it doesn't work, and someday they finally understand that there is a whole community of people like them out there where they can be accepted, where they can relax, where they can be authentic, and that's when they come roaring out of that closet and saying, "This is who I am." That, to me, is gay rage. Behind that fierce, intimidating, aggressive posturing, I think there is the wounding that had its genesis in the schoolyard or earlier. And finally, they come to terms with it. Then they're faced with a family and friends. And usually, even after coming to terms with it, they don't want to immediately come out to family and friends. Was a lesbian comedian, Robin Tyler. Funny woman, really. She did some public stuff on the West Coast. She had a mother living in the East Coast. She didn't figure Mom would ever find out about it. And all of a sudden, Mom called her up one day and said, "Honey, a friend of mine heard a radio interview with you, and you called yourself a dyke." "What's a dyke?" Robin said, "Oh, Mom, it's nothing. I've just become a doctor of young karate experts." That's covering up. That's the fear of, what do I say to the family? And then finally the decision is made, I want them to know. And that's when homosexuality hits home. Now, sometimes there's a scandal or there's an exposure or the information is forced out, but more often than not, when our loved ones tell us that they're gay or lesbian, they do it voluntarily. They want it to. And for many of us, the news is like death. I've had many parents, in fact, say, "You know, I would have rather heard that my son or daughter had a terminal illness than that they were homosexual." There is a sense of death, and in fact, there is a death that occurs. The death of assumptions. We assume things are this way. All of a sudden, we find out they're this way. Sometimes the death of dreams. I thought I'd have grandchildren. I thought I'd have a wife. I thought I'd have a husband or whatever, you know. The death of the family dreams. The death of plans. I expected us to go this way, and now you're telling me that you're going this way. Something dies. Something dies. You may have heard of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She is the doctor who came up with the stages of death and dying. I don't recommend Kubler-Ross philosophically. I think her writing is quite New Age, and many of her ideas are blatantly unbiblical. But I do like the stages of death that she observed in her terminally ill patients and in their loved ones and relatives, and her stages of death, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance, seem to be stages we go through emotionally when we face any kind of death. So I'd like to briefly look at these stages that we seem to go through when homosexuality hits home, and as our assumptions and our expectations die. We are left with certain emotional phases common to the death experience. And hopefully we can learn from others what to do and what not to do. Well, the first phase, of course, denial. And Kubler-Ross found that when people were told they had a terminal illness, immediately it just didn't register. And I find that to be true. Denial is a phenomenon that occurs when we are faced with something too overwhelming to process. We are faced with something too overwhelming to process. In 1988, less than 4 months after I was married, and after over 30 years of putting my family through so much hell and all the ups and downs they had seen me go through and all the struggles that my father and I went through to finally develop some sort of a relationship, and after all the joy I saw in him at my wedding and how he acted like a silly little kid and all the happiness that we were starting to find in each other, he called me and said, "They have found a tumor and I think it's too late." And of course I rejected that. Number one, Dad was too young. He was only in his 60s. Number two, he was far too much of an old goat to let a tumor get him. That wasn't in his nature. I had seen bigger monsters fight the man, and he never gave in. And number three, more than anything else, that simply couldn't happen because we were finally to the point where we could have some sort of a happy ending. And we loved each other very much. And we finally had the opportunity to build on that. It was inconceivable that he would be taken at that time in my life. And so it simply wasn't real. It wasn't happening. Denial. Faced with something too overwhelming to register. You know, about 50% of the phone calls we get at my counseling center are from parents. And you can always get, you basically can tell how recently they found out about their son or daughter's homosexuality by the way they phrase the phone call. You can tell they just found out if they call up and say, "Can you help my daughter? Can you help my son? He thinks he might be homosexual." Why does he think he might be homosexual? "Oh, well, he's been living with this man for about 7 years now, and they bought a house together, and they had a wedding at a gay church. He's confused." That kid's not confused. That kid knows exactly what he's doing. But the understandable response of a parent is, "That couldn't happen. I didn't create my child for this. This is not in the plan." And so the denial. If you are a parent dealing with this in particular, or if you have a gay loved one, if you haven't read any of Barbara Johnson's books, you should. She's a wonderful author, a delightful, godly, zany woman who suffered tremendously and has somehow translated suffering into uproarious laughter. And really, she is the kind of woman you listen to telling this Perils of Pauline story, and you feel so guilty laughing at it. But my Lord, she's a funny woman. Four sons. First one killed in Vietnam. Second son killed in an automobile accident about 6 years later. Third son, after he graduates from seminary with honors, she walks into his bedroom, looks in one of his drawers, and finds homosexual pornography. And as any good mother would do, she said, "Oh, that's not his. I mean, nobody else lived there, but it's not his. Oh, all right, it is his, but it's a homework assignment. He's obviously studying human sexuality, and he needed to look at this for some sort of an examination, never mind that he'd already graduated." Denial. It simply isn't happening. And that is the normal response when we first hear the news. It's important that we admit our limitations when we're faced with something that we can't process. We don't need to force the process along. It'll hit us eventually. In the meantime, we certainly don't want to force that denial on our loved one. I've had people drag their sons or daughters into counseling saying, "Convince this poor soul that she is really not a lesbian." Impossible. Impossible. And certainly you want to delay action until the denial has faded and you're able to face the fact that indeed this is what you're dealing with. this is what you're dealing with. A friend of mine who does work similar to mine down in San Diego had been a very visible leader in the Christian community for some time, very active in many, many causes and crusades and so forth, and had a daughter who one day said, "We need to meet for lunch. I have something to tell you." They met. They ordered. The daughter said, "I'm a lesbian." Mom swallowed down the rest of her lunch, left the table, went home. Could not even deal with it, and that night on the television, on the 6 o'clock news, she heard her husband from the living room say, "Oh my God." They were interviewing her daughter. She had just been elected Miss Gay San Diego, so that was obviously why she had something to tell her mother. And her daughter said, "Now I want you to make a decision. I want you to accept who I am, and I want you to understand that this is who I am, and I want you to tell me what I can expect from you," and so forth. And the woman wisely said, "I'm in shock. You got to give me time. So you certainly don't want to make decisions too quickly. You don't want to take immediate action when you're in the midst of shock. You want to give yourself some time to register the shock." And as denial often does, and the reality of the situation sinks in, it can segue into anger. Oftentimes a response, anger. Once I went to visit my father, and as family members often do, I sneaked some peeks at his chart and saw the word terminal, then it wasn't deniable any longer. Terminal. God, that's an awful word. But there it was. And that's when the rage started. I can't believe this. This is so wrong. This is so unfair. This can't be happening. Blah, blah, blah. And when homosexuality hits home, it's common for that rage to come out as well. It can be the most destructive of all the phases. It can be when terrible things are said. It can be a time where drastic actions are taken that can't be revoked. Barbara Johnson talks very candidly about telling her son she wishes that he had died. She knew how to deal with a dead son. She didn't know how to deal with a homosexual son. Imagine living with that for a while. I had a young man who was sexually addicted come to me for counseling. He told his pastor he had been sexually addicted to homosexual pornography, no less. The pastor had discipled him, must have felt very betrayed. Said to him, "You couldn't possibly be saved if you have feelings like that. You're going to have to leave the church until you really repent." And in desperation, the young man went home and shot himself in the genitals just to prove he really was serious about repentance. A destructive phase. The challenge when we are angry is to be angry without sinning. As Paul said, be angry. No sin in being angry, but when you're angry, don't use your anger as an occasion to sin. Three types of anger you may well deal with if you have a homosexual loved one. It's important to be honest with yourself and with your loved one about which type of anger it is. There is the anger of betrayal. It's a very legitimate anger. If a wife has had a homosexual husband who has lied to her, committed adultery, and possibly endangered her, via the transmission of HIV, she has a right to feel betrayed and angry, legitimate anger. If parents have been lied to and deceived and taken advantage of, they have every right to be angry. That is legitimate. Then there is the anger over loss of control. And I find oftentimes the emergence of homosexuality as a family issue can bring up other family issues that may need to be addressed, and one of them is the issue of control. I remember many times having parents march their adult but relatively young sons or daughters into the counseling office. And by the end of the session, become angrier at me than they are at their son or daughter, because we're starting to point out that there are family pathologies that go beyond homosexuality here. Sometimes the anger is not only that our loved one is homosexual, but also our loved one isn't doing what we want our loved one to do, and we're losing something. We're losing something. And sometimes it's the anger over life and the injustices of it, that all of our plans can be shattered and our expectations can come to nothing. The existential despair. Nothing works out the way I wanted it to, and we're backed up against a wall. It's a very dark turn we take. What comes out of it? Be careful what words you use. And then finally, that can segue into bargaining. Denial, anger, then bargaining. When people are terminally ill, oftentimes they start bargaining for time or bargaining for different approaches. You've probably known people firsthand or seen the stories of people who find out they have cancer and sell everything and go to Mexico to get some new type of a treatment or transfusions or try something exotic or, you know, all of a sudden start grasping for straws they would have never grasped for before. People become desperate. They'll do anything. I know when I finally accepted the fact that Dad was terminally ill, I thought, well, all right, he has cancer, but maybe we can beat this. If he changes his diet, if he changes his patterns, if I love him more, if we do this, if we do that, there's some way that we can bargain our way through this. We look for something. Now, when homosexuality hits home, sometimes the bargaining can be the most constructive phase, because after all the words have been said and the shock and the dust starts to settle, the fact is you're still there, you and your loved one. And that's when you start to say, all right, you have told me about your sexuality, I've told you the way I feel about it, we're both still here, now what do we do? And that is the phase in which you do two things. You clarify expectations, and you clarify boundaries. Clarify expectations and clarify boundaries. There are three crucial questions to be asked of a loved one who is homosexual in looking at expectations. The first is, what does this mean? What does this mean? You tell me you're homosexual, well, does that mean you're sexually active? Does that mean you struggle against homosexuality? Does that mean you've adopted a gay identity? Does that mean you have a lover? What are the implications of this? Because really just saying I'm gay doesn't tell you a whole lot. It says too much and too little at the same time. Well, specifically, what? Have you accepted it? Do you think it's okay? Have you changed your beliefs? Have you modified? What's going on here? What does this mean? Where are you at with your sexuality? Which leads to the second crucial question, what are your intentions? Are you going to pursue a lover? Are you joining in the pro-gay movement? Or do you know what your intentions are? Maybe you don't. That's a legitimate answer. Whatever. What are your intentions in clarifying expectations? I need to know, you've told me this, what am I supposed to expect from you now? Are you going to try to wrestle against it? Are you going to celebrate it? What? And then finally, maybe the most important question, what do you want from me? What do you want from me? You want my love? Yeah, you'll always have that. You want my approval? Can't. You want my attendance at a pro-gay support group? You want me to read a book you have in mind? You want me to say nothing about this? What do you want? What are you asking of me in giving me this information? That helps you clarify what your loved one is expecting of you. And the question should not be put in a rhetorical sense as in, well, what do you want from me? But more like, really, really, what do you want? What do you expect? I'm a conservative Christian. You know where I stand on homosexuality. You know you've hit me with news that was going to throw me for a loop. Okay, what do you want? What are you asking? And that helps clarify boundaries. Your boundaries when your loved one are clarified, when your loved one says to you, I want this, and you negotiate. Say, this I can do, this I can't do. Now, sometimes there are clear biblical mandates for those boundaries. As a Christian, you cannot say to your loved one that black is white, and evil is good. Can't do it. Can't rewrite the Bible to accommodate love. But you do have a lot of liberty as to how you're going to handle the situation. Now, some family members engage in lengthy, lively debates. Every time there's a new program on a new study on the genetic influences towards homosexuality or a gay rights bill or Ellen coming out or a new movie or whatever, the family all gets together and they argue because the gay loved one has this perspective, the family has this perspective, whatever. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with it at all, unless you don't want to. And where a lot of Christian families make a mistake is they let themselves get bamboozled into endless debating over something that is exhausting them. If you like to go on discussing the issue, that's fine and good. It can be interesting, it can be educational. But you may very well reach a point where you say, you know, we've said everything there is to say about this. I'm tired of the subject. I don't want to argue with you anymore. I just want to enjoy you. Let me love you, let's get along, and let's put this issue on the shelf. Don't force it on me, and I won't force it on you. And that, too, is a perfectly legitimate response. At times, especially as we approach the holidays, the questions families always ask will be raised. What if my son wants to bring a lover home? My daughter wants to bring a lover home. Do we let them have Thanksgiving dinner with us? Can they stay in the same room? Do we make them stay in separate rooms? Do we tell them to stay at a hotel? How do we handle it? And this, again, is where Christians have to, first of all, consider what they would allow in their own house. You have to look at your own comfort level and make your decision accordingly. I think it can be a terrible mistake to try to accommodate a gay son and say, look, bring your lover over for dinner, and then all of you sit around in frozen silence and awkwardness and so forth. That can do more damage than it can do good. There are some very good Christian speakers who would say, absolutely, you should have your adult son or daughter bring their lover over. And there are some very good Christian speakers who say you shouldn't. I frankly think it's a matter of conscience. You have to look at your own comfort level. What do you feel comfortable doing in your own home? And you stick to that. That's part of boundaries. We can love our homosexual loved one. That doesn't mean we allow our loved one to dictate policy to us in our own home. That's where we draw the line. That is also true of resources. Sometimes when a family member, a parent, a wife, a brother, sister, whatever, finds out that a loved one is gay, they start doing what I call the classical information exchange. And the books start whizzing through Federal Express. And out go five different copies of books about how people can overcome homosexuality. And in the return mail, there come the books from the people who belong to the gay church and find out that homosexuality is perfectly okay with God. And then out goes some more conservative, and back comes some more liberal. And it's just, you know. And again, you know what? That might be just the ticket for you. You may really enjoy that. you may also get sick of it. And you may also feel like you're banging your head against the wall. And again, on resources, you have the right to basically say, I will not attempt to force you to change, nor will I allow you to attempt to force me to change. You say your sexuality is immutable. I'll respect that. But my beliefs are also immutable. And just as I have no right to try to force you to make a change in that very intimate part of your life, so you have no right to try to force me to change in this equally intimate part of my life. My worldview is not going to be altered by your behavior. I love you. I wish we agreed on everything. But, and I find this is especially relevant today, my love for you is not nullified by my disagreement with you. In a time when there is so much emphasis on multiculturalism and sensitivity and being politically correct, it is often assumed that to disagree is to cancel love and respect. And that is a terribly childish assumption. No relationship operates on that principle. We don't agree totally with anyone, no matter how much we love them. And in every relationship, no matter how intimate, loving, and committed, there is disagreement. To disagree does not nullify the love. Nor do we totally accept everything about anybody we love. I feel deeply loved by my wife. Good Lord and all the saints, she does not approve of everything about me. She has a list. And I suspect I haven't heard half of it. And it is unfair and unrealistic to require that or have it required of us. And so oftentimes a gay loved one will say, if you don't accept my sexuality, you don't accept me. If you don't accept my lover, you don't accept me. If you don't embrace my sexual behavior, then you're really rejecting me in total. Not true. God loves and accepts us. Surely he does not approve of or embrace every part of our lives. And surely we cannot be expected or required to do the same of any other person. And so oftentimes I really think the discussion really turns away from homosexuality and more towards one of maturity and mutual respect. Are we mature enough to have different beliefs? Are we mature enough to have very strong feelings about an issue and still have a relationship? Because if we're not, there's probably something wrong with the relationship. Well, after all the bargaining is done, that can segue into depression, where we've said and done all that can be said, and we're very sad. When the prodigal son came to the father and said, I've made a decision, we don't know what sort of a debate ensued. We don't know what they said to each other. We don't really know what led to the son finally leaving, but we know the father was heartbroken, and we know that the son left. That much we know. And there was nothing left to do but wait in grief. And that is the hardest posture to assume when we love someone. In essence, when someone we love is in sin, we have the terrible but vital task of releasing them to God and to the consequences of their own decisions. We release them to God and to the consequences of their own decisions, and at some point we have to take care of ourselves. At some point we have to recognize there is nothing more I can do about this situation, but I can do something about my own grief. That's the time to beef up your relationships. Look at your social life. Look at your allies. Take full advantage of the love that's available to you. Look again at your calling. Look again at your own sense of purpose in life. What has meaning for you? Now, Viktor Frankl, psychiatrist who was imprisoned in Auschwitz during the Holocaust, noticed during his time in the camp that of all of the prisoners who had avoided selection and weren't sent off to the gas chambers, the ones that were put to work, and you know they were on starvation diets and slave labor that they were put through. You've seen the pictures, horrible stuff. The ones who had the best chance of survival, he noticed, were the ones who had some sense of meaning. They lived for something. There was something that mattered to them, something they wanted to accomplish, something they had a passion for. It kept them going. It's the time to get in touch with that. And finally, amazingly, that depression will evolve into acceptance. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. Not the acceptance of the problem as being legitimate. Not the acceptance of homosexuality. But the acceptance of the situation the way it is and the willingness to live with it as it is. One crucial thing to know about your loved one who is homosexual, by and large, that still is the same person you've always loved. That person really hasn't changed. Now, you know a little more about that person than you did before, but she hasn't changed. He hasn't changed. And all of the wonderful things that you knew about that person before are still intact. The relationship is still manageable. Now, my friend down in San Diego who does this type of work has a wonderful relationship with her daughter, and her daughter has been actively militant for the past decade or so. In fact, she has headed up some of the largest gay organizations in the country. And yet they get together whenever they can, have lunch, go for little trips, thoroughly enjoy each other. Now, if the subject comes up, you better believe they have some interesting things to say to each other, because this woman sponsors a conference every year on how to come out of homosexuality, and her daughter sponsors conferences every year on how to raise funds for the pro-gay cause. Fascinating conversations. But they're both smart enough to know that life is very short. They can either spend it arguing, or they can enjoy each other as much as possible. And they're fortunate and blessed in the fact that they will enjoy each other. And interestingly enough, whenever the daughter loses a lover or goes through a crisis, mom's the first one to hear about it. And she has by no means given up hope. Paul did not end his ministry in what we would call victorious terms. If we were going by the common American ideology, we could even say he was a failure. The end of his life, almost everybody had rejected him, had left him. He had lost most of his allies. He was in prison. He was facing execution. He was an unpopular man who was not wealthy and had nothing set aside for his retirement. And yet he said with confidence, "I know who I believe. And I am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him." For us, when homosexuality hits home, it is ultimately a test of our confidence in God's ability to keep the loved one, the husband, the wife, the daughter, the son, the brother, the father, that we had committed to him so many times so long ago. And somehow, in the middle of our pain, we come to peace with that. And that, I believe, is the beginning of healing in the family when homosexuality hits home.
Thank you for joining us in this 6-part series on homosexuality, A Christian Response. If you'd like more copies of this tape series, please contact us at American Family Living at 1774 North LaSalle Street, Orange, California, 92865. Or call us at 714-637-7900. We have a lovely web page which includes Genesis Counseling. You can reach us both at www.AmericanFamilyLiving.org. If you'd like to contact Joe Dallas directly for counseling or to have him speak at your church or conference, he can be reached at Genesis Counseling at 1774 North LaSalle Street, Orange, California, 92865. You can also reach him at his voicemail, 714-502-1463. That's 714-502-1463. We put this series together as a tool for you and would love to hear from you. Please take a moment to contact us and let us know if this series has been helpful to you. We appreciate your prayers for Genesis and American Family Living. Thank you for joining Joe and I, and God bless you.